comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana. The Corkscrew carries a full line of wines, beers, and spirits for everyone from the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Friday from 6 to 8 p.m. and Saturday from 2 to 6. Information available at 337-7704 or on the web at thecorkscrew.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, Champaign's exclusive Subaru dealer on Route 45 in Savoy. Online at wardenmartin.com. The phone number is 217-352-8910 for Warden Martin Subaru in Savoy.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Matthew Simmons is our guest this afternoon. He heads an investment bank that specializes in the energy industry. He's also the author of a new book that says Saudi Arabian oil production is at or very near its peak sustainable volume. The book is Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy. Simmons questions the assumption held by many, including the U.S. government, that Saudi oil is so plentiful that it will keep up with demand at least through the year 2030. The assumption has been that the Saudis will produce from 20 to 25 million barrels a day for the next 20 to 30 years. But Simmons points out, quoting here, that in reality, the kingdom's demonstrated production capacity in 2004 was on the order of 10 million barrels a day. In other words, one half the estimate. And Simmons says one factor complicating the situation is the reluctance, the refusal on the part of Saudi Arabia to date to allow third-party verification of their oil reserves while they encourage the world to believe the kingdom has plenty of oil. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. I invite your questions and comments for our guest, Matthew Simmons. You can join the discussion with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Matthew Simmons is Chairman and Chief Executive Officer of Simmons & Company International, a Houston-based investment bank that specializes in the energy industry. His book, Twilight in the Desert, is published by Wiley. 333-9455 and 800-222-9455. Matthew Simmons, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be on your program.
Sure. When and why did you begin to question Saudi oil sustainability?
Well, I've spent the last 3.5 decades as an energy investment banker, and I think throughout that period of time, I've just had a high degree of curiosity about where does data come from? I learned early on that there were all sorts of energy myths that people passed on that weren't supported by data. It kind of became the hallmark of our firm. As we got into the late 90s and early 2000, I was paying very careful attention to how quickly demand was growing and how so many experts assumed that demand was probably peaking 10 years ago. And every time I looked at this, I saw these long-term forecasts that assumed that as demand could go to almost any level conceivable, and Saudi Arabia would always basically just continue to open its valves and produce more oil. And I thought, this is unbelievable. There's almost no data on Saudi Arabia's oil. I wonder why people always assume this. I did a study at one point about the world's giant oil fields and found to my surprise that actually there weren't all that many that really great oil fields. And there were, it appeared that there were about 5 oil fields in Saudi Arabia that were producing 90% of their oil, and they were all old oil fields. And so I just had these doubts about why do people think so, firmly that the Middle East has unlimited amounts of oil when there's some likelihood they don't. And then out of the blue, quite by happenstance, I was invited to be part of a 9-person delegation to travel to Saudi Arabia in late January 2003, and spent 6 days having these fabulous visits with government officials about what's going on in Saudi Arabia. And every time we got into discussions about oil, I was keenly listening, interested in listening. And we finally got a trip to Dairon, the headquarters of Saudi Aramco, and these special presentations by their technical people about all the technology. And I was listening carefully and thinking, why are they doing all this? Because if they really basically have 90 years of proven reserves and they've almost cost this to produce, they're spending a fortune for a country that really doesn't have a lot of money. This is before oil prices went through the roof. And I came back armed with a better knowledge of what to start looking for. And I found that within the library of the Society of Petroleum Engineers were hundreds of technical papers written over the years about small study areas of these handful of great fields. And so I came to Maine 2 summers ago convinced I'd do a sort of a white paper. And by the time I'd gotten through about 150 of these papers, I thought, you know, this is really a stunning paper trail that questions seriously our core energy assumption we built the global economy on, unlimited amounts of oil in the Middle East. That's actually when I decided to go from a white paper to a book, and I then spent the next 2 years, not nonstop because I am running an investment banking firm, but really spent a lot of serious time researching everything I could get my hands on that ended up culminating in the book that came out 2 months ago.
Yeah. Now, what kind of response is your book getting from those who believe the claims that Saudi oil fields are very productive today and that the kingdom could increase oil reserves with new discoveries and increased recovery?
Well, interestingly enough, now that I have, I guess, 7 weeks or almost 8 weeks under my belt with the book out and about 50,000 copies that people are apparently reading, I've had about 10 reports of people who have really scoffed at this, and all the reasons they're giving are the same reasons that the petroleum ministry started putting out a year and a half ago, some of which came out before my book was even out. And I'm now in possession of about 600 to 800 detailed comments from people that have read the book that have just given phenomenal praise to be taking the time to do this. So I really expected 2 months ago that within the first month I'd be hit by just a barrage of unbelievably negative publicity. But, maybe the people that think it's so stupid just didn't want to spend the time reading it.
Mm-hmm. What about the powers that be?
Well, I think I'm getting a lot of interesting letters from people in various governments around the world, and from pretty senior people within all but the major oil companies. I've had a lot of comments from VP level people in major oil companies that have all been very favorable. And again, so far, to my really utter astonishment, the favorable comments that sometimes have been so flattering, I just can't believe it, have been running about 500 to 1.
Mm. You note in the book Twilight in the Desert that at the end of 2004, the Saudi oil minister said reserves could be increased by 77% within a few years.
Yeah.
Couple of questions here. I know what your answer is going to be to the first one. Could he be right? But then the second question is, what motivates him to make such a claim?
I think pride. I actually believe that they believe that their boasts are real. And that's actually probably a little bit more disturbing than the fact they said, oh, we know this isn't real, but we'd like to just, make it up. But, the history of the oil industry is rife with companies in the last 10 years that thought they were on the road to production growth, and all they were on the road for was a production decline. So this isn't just Saudi Arabia.
Mm. I mentioned in my introduction the reluctance on the part of the Saudis to open their books on what their reserves contain. Why the reluctance?
Well, it's interesting. There's a article coming out that I just read today in the New York Times Sunday Magazine that quotes them as the cover story. It's on all of these issues. And some senior official there says, well, it's, we're the central bank of oil. And, people have a good right to ask central banks how much money you have, and central banks should tell you. But if the person then says, well, I'd like to come in and count the money, the answer is absolutely no. I thought it was a preposterously kind of funny response as to, being the central bank, all you have to do is ask us and we'll tell you the answer.
Hmm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Matthew Simmons, our guest today on the program. Listeners, you can join us with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a couple of listeners. First, we go to a caller in Champaign-Urbana on line one. Hello.
Hi, interesting. The term proven reserves has always been questionable, but there's a website, Hubbard's Peak, and they mentioned many, many years ago some companies, you know, were pretty freely giving out info and everyone assumed they were accurate. And then about 1960, that all became like company secrets. But what about these firms like Petrologix that watches tanker loadings? Are they of any use to anyone? And great comment.
Petrologix, which I mentioned in the book, is an unbelievably important firm for petroleum data, because they're sort of the first source of how much oil is being exported out of the Middle East. And all I've been able to uncover, and it's been written up in the Wall Street Journal once, the New York Times once, is that Petrologix is a one-man firm, and he resides over a grocery store in Geneva. And theoretically, he has a bunch of harbor spies that are on all the major harbors of the world, and they look through binoculars and plumb lines in their window and say, that tanker looks like it has so much oil on board, and if there's any doubt where it's going, they sneak aboard and look at the bill of lading, and that becomes our finest information on our oil flows out of the Middle East. That's the first of all, who benefits from that? I guess it must be the oil traders that are paying him to spread this information.
Hmm. And a comment on that turn of phrase, proven reserves.
It was a tragedy that the industry somehow coined the term proven reserves, because it really has a connotation of being proven. The only technology we'll ever have to know how much proven reserves an oil field had is when we finally cap the last well and count up how much was produced. The art form that's involved of trying to estimate proven reserves is really vague. And all this technology we created actually made it, in a funny sense, vaguer versus easier. So that's why we had this incident last year where Shell Oil Company was the gold standard of the major oil companies. They thought in the start of 2003 they had 21 billion barrels of proven reserves, and by year end they thought they had 13.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Charleston on line four. Hi.
Yes, a couple of questions. First, has your guest heard or read any of the information in, I think the little book is called Peaked Oil, and have you familiar with that?
Do you remember who wrote that?
Well, I don't have it in front of me just now, but the publication seems to be an elongated quote, quotes from different sources.
Yeah.
But the upshot of it is that oil peaked in the 1970s, and there was a news report just before this program about Jimmy Carter and his collision with the oil crisis.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And then this book points to that oil peaked then, and then since been on the decline.
Yeah, they're referring to oil in the United States, which peaked in December 1970, and if it's probably the book. There's two books out of the last 4 years by Professor DeFays, Kenneth DeFays. He's a professor of geology emeritus at Princeton, and they're both really good books to read. They tell the story about how the United States was in denial that we were at peak until about 10 years after it was clear we'd peaked, and we were already down 30% from the lower 48, and a lot of good data about why it's probably likely the world is now reaching peak oil.
On a world scale.
That was the 70s was U.S.
Yes.
Today it's a world scale.
All right. Thank you for that. Then the other aspect of this is, I think David Inge had a program about the biofuels not long ago, and I think Celeste had a man on not long ago that about the same subject matter of the oil reserves and how we are going to function civilly with these crises that are upon us.
Yes.
And then, which then leads to my thinking about this whole situation is that, of course, civilizations have come and gone. History is full of that. And this oil-based civilization, which to me is apparent and is upon us, and if we think somehow, if we don't do something, something, in my estimation, is always some sort of revolution that will overturn the status quo and to create a new paradigm by which the bulk of humanity is going to survive these crises that are beating the door down. And if something is not done soon in a revolutionary sense of however that evolves, you know, my views come from Marxism, and that points to violence, which, you know, if that's the last resort, then we're all in trouble.
Yeah.
And so, it's just mind-boggling that we have this place in Africa and many places in Africa where these people are starving to death, and all the fossil fuels are blowing up into the air and ruining the atmosphere and holding in the heat. It's just impossible to think we can burn the last drop of oil and then try to create a new paradigm.
Yeah. Now, I think, you know, I guess at the end of the day, even though I'm getting accused right now of being one of the most pessimistic people on earth, and I actually think I'm an optimist, and I know I'm an optimist, and I actually believe that if we have a huge wake-up call today and we take this seriously and we basically react as aggressively as the Western powers did starting the 1st of September 1939, when we had to create a war machine from scratch in 5 years, that within a 5 to 7 year period of time, we could actually transform our economies and the way we use oil in an amazing way and get along with a slowly declining oil base before we end up having a collapse of civilizations we know it. Because if you ignore the problem, it could be, you know, all these Apocalypse Now books being written now could actually be modest. But I guess what gives me, you know, optimism is that there are a bunch of things we could start doing now that within 5 to 7 years we could actually significantly lessen the energy dependence on our economy and have the economy work well.
Mm-hmm. And in one of the books that the gentleman from Charleston was mentioning, the guest was James Kunstler, the author James Kunstler. He was on the program not long ago. His book, The Long Emergency, predicts an end to cheap energy and therefore causing an end to globalism, suburbia, and consumer culture.
Yeah. Well, I've never met Mr. Kunstler. We're going to be on a program together in Dallas on, I think, November 1st. I've read the summary of his book. I need to read the whole thing, but it is a pretty scary way it pans out, and I think that can easily happen. But if we don't pay attention to these things, but I actually think we can pay attention to these things, and it doesn't need to be such a dark ending.
Mm. Let's talk with another listener, caller in Eureka on line one. Hello.
Very interesting and timely program, and I think you're exactly right about making some changes. Could I ask three very short questions, please? You gave at the beginning of the show present projections that in how long will things drastically fall off in terms of production and demand?
Well, first of all, nobody knows. I mean, anybody trying to tell you the dates is like someone trying to have predicted in 1939 when World War II was going to start. But I think that the risk of us now being at sustained peak oil production is sufficiently high that it would really behoove everyone to assume we've already passed it and act accordingly. And then if it turns out that we were wrong by 5 years, it's a fabulous cushion.
Uh-huh. There
is a risk that Saudi Arabia's oil production could soon go into swift decline, by swift being down in 30 or 60 months by 30 or 50%.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the fact that you could say anyone saying that's no risk doesn't have any idea what the oil fields are like in Saudi Arabia, and they ought to spend time reading my book before they say that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the fact that that's even a 30 or 40 or 50% risk is so cataclysmic, if we don't pay attention to it, we should assume the risk is real and plan accordingly and then be pleased if it wasn't, because we have a little bit more time if some of these changes don't happen as fast as they need to.
It is said that some of the greatest reserves now besides Saudi Arabia are the old Soviet Union, I guess primarily Soviet Central Asia,
mm-hmm.
and maybe parts of Russia. How much accuracy is there to that statement in terms of there being maybe st- still a lot of undiscovered oil, and they aren't producing it at their peak. Is there any accuracy or any?
There's no accuracy to that data. It's actually a state secret in Russia to actually even mention reserves. So it's been a long, long time since there's been any significant new oil discoveries in Russia per se.
Mm-hmm.
And there was such unbelievable pressure on the oil industry in the 60s and the 70s as they were fighting the arms race with only one, you know, source of revenue, that if there were more things to be found, they would have found them.
Uh-huh.
So in Central Asia, there's still some potentially big oil fields that there's a lot of hope that are going to come on and be a big source of supply. There's a field called Kashagan in the eastern end of the Caspian Sea that about $60 billion is being poured into, and the major oil companies doing that are very confident they wouldn't be sitting $60 billion, that by 2016 it might be producing 1.2 million barrels a day, and that by 2009 it might start up at 75,000 barrels a day. But it's a very complicated reservoir and or series of reservoirs, and even if it all works, that's a long, long time to wait to bring on a 1.2 million barrels a day when the world is now consuming 85 million barrels a day.
Final, do you have any opinions to Daniel Yergin? I believe he was the author of a book, The Prize,
yep.
And it was a PBS documentary,
yep.
The History of Oil. What is your...
Well, I've known Dan for 20-some-odd years, and I think I was one of the... Dan claims I was one of the first people to have finished The Prize and said, Dan, I bet you get a Pulitzer Prize on it. It's a fabulous history book.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really know why, but the same week the book came out, Sarah, Dan's firm, and Dan have been on the stump all summer, touting a very detailed bottoms-up, field-by-field supply survey that they believe that between now and 2010, the world will add 16.4 million barrels a day. They sort of mutters net of depletion, and then they ignore depletion. And I've carefully read the 51-page study, and I think it's actually preposterous.
Uh-huh.
And very dangerous to be telling the world. First of all, it's not a bottoms-up. It's not, you know, only about a third of the added production is mentioned by any specific fields. And I don't know why he's basically going so far out on a limb to make people feel so comfortable that we have another glut arriving and a price collapse.
Mm-hmm.
If he's wrong, people should remember that Dan is a fabulous historian.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is The Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Matthew Simmons. He's chairman and chief executive officer of Simmons & Company International, a Houston-based investment bank that specializes in the energy industry. And he is the author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock, and The World Economy, the book published by Wiley. My name is Celeste Quinn, and listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with your questions for our guest, Matthew Simmons. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. What kinds of changes would we need to make today to soften the coming blow?
Well, the 70% of the oil use in the United States and the oil use worldwide is in the transportation markets. And about 98% of our modern forms of transportation are fueled by oil. So all the changes basically have to take place in the transportation markets. That's where you win the battle or lose the battle. And what you have to do, in my opinion, is a lot of things that people talk about doing are possible, but they just take too long. So you effectively have to do several things simultaneously. And let me quickly list some of the things that I think are the easiest to implement, even though none of them are simple. We today around the world use as much or more diesel fuel transporting goods by truck than we use in motor gasoline transporting people. And it turns out that large trucks are unbelievably energy inefficient. They get 4 to 6 miles per gallon. They actually cause most of our worst traffic congestions. And if we get over a 5 to 7 year period of time, get the large trucks carrying goods over long distances off the highways and onto rail beds, and even better, onto marine-based transportation on the water, you basically affect, depending on the length of the trip, the length of the train or the ability to get it on water, which is the single best solution, you get an energy efficiency savings of between 3 and 20 times.
Hmm.
Not 3 and 20%. That all of a sudden makes the Mississippi River and the Ohio River and the Eastern Coast port cities unbelievably competitive as an efficient way to get to move goods. We've got to rebuild our railroads to be able to do that. In Europe, they have a real problem, though. They don't have a river system like we do, and their railroads are filled with people versus goods. So it's more of a conundrum in Europe than it is in the United States, but we have to do that. At the same time, we have to really radically change the way we distribute a whole bunch of our fresh foods. It's amazing what a high percentage of foods, if you go into a grocery store today, come from 5 to 20,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm.
And the energy consumed in that transportation, and particularly when a lot of those vessels go back empty to be reloaded, is unbelievable. But since energy was so cheap, we never thought about it. Third thing we need to do is learn how to basically work close to home and keep our same jobs. And what I find interesting, once I started thinking about this, I thought, gosh, it's amazing how simple some of this stuff is. There are lots of large corporations that still have 20 to 50,000 people working in one location on the concept, well, we need to have that so we can all communicate, and yet 98% of the people never communicate with anybody to begin with. But they spend an hour and a half going to work and an hour and a half getting home from work, and we have the technology in place that we developed in the last 20 years. It's called the Internet. It's called video conferencing. It's called the telephone. It's called the fax. That a large percent of those people could actually be allowed to shift to working at home or working in their village, even walking to work, and they'd have lots of free time. They'd become more efficient at what the jobs they're doing. That's harder to do when you're making things. And we could do that also in a 5 to 7 year period of time. And then finally, a very high percentage of the goods we manufacture today are broken down into their smallest components, and we seek out the cheapest sweatshop economy to have them made. And then we zing them to someplace else and assemble them into a product, and then that gets zinged to someplace else, and finally we end up with a finished car, for instance. If we basically go back to trying to figure out how to make things very close to where they're used, which we have the technology to do today, you have another step change in the consumption of energy. And if you did all of those things and we made sure that we taught China and India, for instance, how to do all those same things, we could potentially get along with maybe a third less oil while we go on an intense R&D program and things like biofuels, the biofuels that work versus the things like corn-based ethanol. It's just too energy-intensive to make any sense, and hopefully invent some new forms of energy to start really significantly taking the place of oil as it goes into steeper decline.
Hmm. Would there be much pain? Would there be pain, any pain, with the things that you've listed here this afternoon?
Well, sure. I mean, but relative to, like, the trucking industry, a trucking executive hearing what I just said must think, the guy's crazy. But you know what's interesting is the truck bodies actually then go on trains.
Mm-hmm.
And someone would end up figuring out a way to invent some form of rapid, system of pulling goods off a train when it slows down, and some small, very efficient fleet of trucks to get it from the train depot to deliver to where it was going and make a fortune, become a new FedEx. In the meantime, the trucking companies as we know today would slowly wither away, but, there have been lots of industries that have slowly withered away, and out of it come some great new industries.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Monterey, Indiana, line 4. Hi.
Yeah, I totally agree with the man on the getting the trucks off the highway, getting the goods hauling back to the rails. But I had another question. I've been wondering all along, what is happening to the oil that comes out of the North Slope? It seems to me that the United States itself is a pretty good-sized reservoir of oil. Why don't we use it? Why don't we even hear about it?
Well, North Slope oil was one of the last three great frontiers to be discovered in the late 60s. And when it peaked in the late 80s, we had 2 million barrels a day coming from the North Slope. And we shut down any more exploration about 10, 15 years after the North Slope even started. And now we have about 950,000 barrels a day of oil coming from the North Slope. Prudhoe Bay, which was the only really giant field that for over 10 years was 1.5 million barrels a day, is down to about 300,000 barrels a day before a bunch of satellite fields are added in and they say, oh, it's 400,000. But, you know, for a decade and a half, we've had this viciously ugly debate about opening ANWR or the Alaskan Wildlife Oil Refuge or not opening ANWR. And too many people said they can't do that. The ANWR is a North American Serengeti, and where they're going to drill is basically a tundra that's loaded with mosquitoes in the summer and ice in the winter, 200 or 300 miles away from these mountain ranges that got shown thousands of times on television to raise money to defeat ANWR. Then the skeptics say even if they find oil, it would only be 45 or 60 days total supply. Well, that's a test that assumes we shut everything else in America down. So on that basis, we wouldn't do anything. I think ANWR has to happen. I suspect it will happen this year finally. And then the question becomes, will we find any oil there? Because we've only drilled one well in that entire area. If we do, it's very significant, even if it's 100,000 or 200,000 barrels a day. But it doesn't basically add enough to start making up for the inevitable decline in Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's true. But the point is, who's actually getting that oil out of there now? What?
Well, the major oil companies are the owners of the production that's now 950,000 barrels a day.
Oh.
And they're doing everything possible to keep that up. But you know, in a brief, you know, 15 years, we've gone from 2 million barrels a day to 950,000 barrels a day, which highlights one more time how fast the decline comes once you peak.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Well, okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call this afternoon. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Matthew Simmons, author of the book Twilight in the Desert. Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Savoy, line one, hi.
Yeah, you know, we've kind of followed, liquid petroleum projections and everything like that. And one of the, you know, one of the key reasons that petroleum is used for transportation is the special feature of transportation is energy density. In other words, the energy contained in a gallon of diesel fuel or jet fuel is just so much greater than you can cram into anything else. And, you know, that's the whole reason that it's used, and that's why it's essential for transportation. And one of the things that I'd kind of like to explore, you know, there's been some calculations done, you know, to totally replace the United States' dependency on oil, you'd only have to gasify or convert about 100 pounds of coal per person per day in the United States into liquid fuels. And I can tell you right now, we're sitting on a continent of coal. You know, have you ever taken that into account?
You know, I don't really know enough about coal gasification into liquids to speak knowledgeably about it. I'm a little bit less sanguine. First, I'm such a skeptic about energy stuff where we don't have any good data. And I don't think our coal data is any better than our oil data.
I think it's a lot better.
The coal maps of
Illinois have been known for really since the 1850s.
Yeah.
And it's enormous.
Well, that hopefully it is, and hopefully we have, but we've got to figure out a way to do this on a non-energy intensive basis. And this is where I just don't know enough about the technology of turning coal to liquids. I know in gas to liquids, you use up about two-thirds of the gas to turn it into liquids.
No, that's not true. To convert a pound of coal to liquid fuel, you get about 60% of...
Okay, well, as I say, I was using GTL or gas to liquid.
Yeah, yeah. You get about 60% efficiency from, you know, from the time you start until you get into the fuel you want.
So I think we've got to figure out all sorts of fronts to create new ways to transport things while we've actually stopped transporting things as far as we do.
Yeah. You know, all this talk about hydrogen fuels and...
Oh, hydrogen's not a primary form of energy.
No,
it's
a fool's errand. And whenever you talk transportation, you have to have liquid fuels.
Yeah, we have to have liquid fuels.
Okay, hey, we'll see you later.
Thanks for the call. This is the Afternoon Magazine. We have about 10 minutes left in this portion of the program. Our guest today is Matthew Simmons. He heads an investment bank that specializes in the energy industry. He is the author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock, and The World Economy. This is the Afternoon Magazine. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free. 800-222-9455. In the early 1970s, the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia boosted their oil production. It shot skyward. How were they able to do that?
Well, first of all, put in context what was going on. Out of the blue, the United States, which had been the biggest oil producer on Earth by a factor of almost 50% higher than anyone else, peaked and started into what became a fairly rapid decline, while the world's growth in oil demand jumped from 45 million barrels a day in 1969 to 55 million barrels a day in 1974 to 65 million barrels a day in 1979. So that's astonishing growth. And the only countries on Earth that had the ability to just open their taps because they were pressuring in the production to carefully maintain reservoir pressures were Iran and Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia went with the same number of wells, basically, more or less, from 3 million barrels a day in 1970 to 8 million barrels a day in 1974 by just opening the valves. And what's interesting is when you go back and you read the interesting paperwork, including a Senate hearing where a bunch of papers were subpoenaed on to answer the charges. Were they intentionally actually maybe damaging these oil fields to just get the last syllable drops out? There were, without any question, people within the four major oil companies that owned the Aramco companies that knew that these fields could never produce 20 to 25 million barrels a day. They just convinced Saudi Arabia they could produce that. And out of that came this myth that, oh, the Middle East has so much oil, it doesn't matter how much they produce. You can just keep opening the valves, and if you ever need to find more, just drill some more wells. And what's so interesting is that once we got out of our oil crisis in 1973 and our oil crisis in 79, we basically spent the next three decades worrying more about the Middle East somehow flooding the world with oil than anyone ever saying, I wonder basically whether those early charges about these oil fields were never quite as productive could have been true.
Yeah. Well, in the book, you write about Seymour Hersh and his reporting for the New York Times in 79.
Yeah.
The article, Saudi Oil Capacity Questioned.
Yeah. You know, the funny thing is I've heard from my friend Jeff Girth at the New York Times, who was the understudy to Cy Hersh, that he wanted to basically do about a 2-3 or 4-page story about that. And the New York Times people said, well, Cy, first of all, you're Jewish. Have you ever been there? And he said, no. And they said, well, how do you know anything about the Middle East oil? And he said, well, I hadn't been to My Lai either. He just won the Pulitzer Prize for doing his My Lai Vietnam investigation. But for some reason, they chopped that down to about a 3-paragraph article. And so one more time, people should have started thinking, I wonder what that's all about. And we didn't.
Mm. Let's talk with some other listeners. Next, we go to Urbana. Caller on line one. Hi.
How are you? Back in the 70s, I think when Carter was president, they had these oil shell conversion plants out west.
Mm-hmm.
And then they were talking also then about in Alberta, Canada, there was like these huge fields of like tarry-like oil substance they could convert if the price became high enough for you know, liquid crude. And I'm wondering if you know anything about or you would discuss that part of it.
Yep, the oil shale is still there.
Mm-hmm.
We have billions of barrels of it. There's actually some new technological work being done right now on trying to figure out if there's any way to make oil shale less energy intense, even get more of that out of the ground. And I hear actually someone at the Department of Energy a couple of weeks ago sent me some stuff to read. I haven't had a chance to do that. I hear basically that there's some promise maybe that'll work.
Mm-hmm.
The bitumen or the tar sands in Canada are very real, but they're bitumen.
Yeah.
And to get it out of the ground, you have to inject an enormous amount of heat, and then you ooze it out of the ground, and you refine it into very low-quality oil, and then you dilute it with high-quality oil to end up creating synthetic crude.
Oh.
So it's there.
Yeah. I agree with what you've been saying about the Saudi fields, because I read, I think I read one of your articles or something about your business, and where Saudi Arabia, basically no one knows what's really going on in the Arabian peninsulas, and you know, it's like a closed society, so why do they admit anything? So, and I really agree with what you're saying. I think people need to be smarter about this, and thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Next, we go to a listener in Champaign, line two. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was under the impression when they developed the North Sea or the North Slope oil fields that the oil had to come down to the lower 48, and then somewhere about the Carter administration or so, that was changed so they could ship it overseas because it was a better market or cheaper or something. Do you have any information on that?
Well, that's the North Slope, and I believe that almost all of the North Slope production, once it gets to Valdez and loaded on tankers, still comes to the United States. I think now it's legal to take it elsewhere, but I think, you know, the best market and the highest paying market and the closest market is the USA. So if we do any North Slope oil outside the U.S., it's small. The North Sea, that came on about the same time, it became the last great new frontier miracle. It goes all over.
Okay, well, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we talk with a listener in Urbana, line three. Hi.
Hi, Mr. Simmons. This is Abdul. I'm born in Somalia, and my dad used to work for a company called Sinclair Oil Company, and later bought by ConocoPhillips.
Mm-hmm.
And 1993, when Somalia had this problem of government and people were dying, and Bush administration, which is the early Bush administration, went to Somalia. The places that they used was owned by Conoco, and they still have the rights of oil to get out of. That question was burning me all these years, whether there's oil. You hear all these articles that say, oh, there's a big hope that they might get large oil reserves. Is that true or not?
Well, a lot of East Africa has barely been explored. There's been a little bit of exploration in Sudan. There's been a little bit of exploration in Kenya. There's been a tiny bit of exploration, further south. I don't know about Somalia. What's interesting, though, is that in Saudi Arabia, there's been exploration going on since the 1930s. And all they ever found of any promise was in a very small area along the Arabian the Persian Sea, the Arabian Sea, and every place else just didn't have any oil.
Thanks.
Thanks for the call, and let's get in one more call this afternoon before we have to wrap up. Listener in Chicago, line four. Good afternoon.
It was stated long ago that the internal combustion engine was the most inefficient mechanism long ago, at the time of the oil price increases that skyrocketed back then. We had the handwriting on the wall, but chose not to act in terms of making more efficient automobiles and things that could have really accommodated greater economy in the use of oil. And even with comments about the fuels in Alaska, well, it seems that if once we do get into another alternative fuel source, those petroleum products would be better served to be used for more efficient things, such as in pharmaceuticals and other things, as they are now to some extent. So the quicker we can get into some alternative fuel source, we'll be way ahead of the game. So to make that comment.
Yeah, I think that we're going to have to find the most efficient use for oil. I just like to maybe finish by just marveling, though, that when you think about how small a volume of liquid is in a gallon, and to take a gallon, and even in an SUV that can hold comfortably six people and lots of stuff, that you can basically go 20 miles on that gallon of energy makes me think, we were really lucky to have the internal combustion engine, but we probably actually created an unsustainable society that assumed that we could just use gallons as long as we ever wanted to use them, and we're going to have to change. And the changes we can make will make us all a better place to live.
There we have to leave it. We're out of time. Mr. Simmons, thank you very much for joining us
this
afternoon.
These have been really excellent questions.
Matthew Simmons has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. He's chairman and chief executive officer of Simmons & Company International, a Houston-based investment bank that specializes in the energy industry, and he is the author of Twilight in the Desert, The Coming Saudi Oil Shock and the World Economy. The book is published by Wiley. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Thank you very much, Celeste. From the Chicago Board of Trade this afternoon, futures finished the day like this in the wheat pit. Futures were up 4 cents for the September contract. They settled at 314.5, they settled at 314.25. They were once again up 4 cents. Their high for the day finished like this at 314.5, a low at 310. The next contract in the wheat pit, the December futures, 329.5, the high, the low at 324.75. The settlement price there at 329.25, and they were up 4.25 for the day. March futures, 342, the high, the low at 337.25. Settlement price at 341.75, up 4. May futures in the wheat pit, 348, the high, the low at $3.44. Settlement price up on that high of $3.48, up 4 for the day. And July futures were up 2.75 for next year's harvest month, 350, the high, the low at 46. And a settlement price at $3.49. September corn futures at the Chicago Board of Trade had a high today of $2.13, the low at $2.08. Settled a lot closer to that high at $2.13 even. They were up 3.5 cents for the SEPs. December futures up 4.25 today. A settlement price at $2.26.5 for the December corn, with a high of $2.26.75, a low at $2.21.25. And once again, the December futures settled $2.26.5, and they were up 4.25 on the day. March contract in the corn pit, 236.5, the high, the low at 31. Settlement price at $2.36.25 a bushel. They were up 4.25, and the May futures were up 4 cents, with a high of $2.42.5, a low at $2.37, and a settlement price there at $2.42.25. Now, July corn futures for next year, 246.75, the high, the low at 41.5, a settlement price at $2.46.75. They were up 4.25 on the day. And the September contract at $2.49.5, high, low at 244.75. Settlement price there at $2.48. They were up 2.5 cents for the day. September futures in the oat pit, 151.75, the high, the low at 47.5, and a settlement price at $1.51.75, up 1.25. December oats were up 0.5 cent. With a settlement price at 160.25, the high at 160.5, the low at 155.75 in the December oats. Soy complex now beans down nearbys in 1.75 cents lower for the September's. November's were off 0.25. Everything else up just a bit for the day. September futures in the bean pit, $6.20.5, the high, the low at $6.09.5, a settlement price at $6.15, down 1.75 cents today. November beans were down 0.25 cents. They had a high of $6.30, a low at $6.18, and a settlement price at $6.24.75 for your harvest month November beans. January futures, $6.35.5, the high, the low at $6.24.5, settlement price there at $6.31.5, up 1 on the day. In the March contract, a $6.38.5 high, low at $6.27. Settlement price at $6.34.25, up 1.75. May futures in the bean pit, $6.41, the high, the low at $6.28, settled $6.38. They were up 2.5 cents. In July futures for next year, settled 3.25 higher at $6.41.5, with a high of 44 and a low at $6.32. September bean meal, $194.50, the high, low at $1.97, and a settlement price at $191.60, up a dollar, rather down $1.10. And the October bean meal off $1.30 today, with a settlement price at $191.50, the high at $194.50, the low at $190.50 even. Soybean oil futures, $22.65, the high, the low at $22.25, settlement price $22.60, they were up 31. And the October bean oil, $22.73 on the high, the low at $22.35, settlement price there at $22.67, they were up 28. At 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock, not too awfully far away, we'll talk with Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, about the marketplace in Chicago and what he thinks the price forecast might be for both corn and soybeans. And don't forget to join me tomorrow morning on the South Farms here in Urbana-Champaign for the University of Illinois' Agronomy Day. Starts at 7 a.m. in the morning, with tours departing on hour-long tours around the South Farms. Your chance to see the scientists and researchers that have been working all year long for you. From the University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences, I am University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, and Celeste Quinn is here now with a look at the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Mostly higher day today for livestock prices, Todd. August feeder cattle, 110.30, the high, 109.95, the low, the settlement, 110.25, that up 32.5. September, 108.20, the high, 107.42.5, the low, the settlement, 107.62.5, that up 22.5. October, 106.90, the high, the low, 106.25, the settlement, 106.32.5, that up 2.5. August live cattle, 79.25, the high, 78.65, the low, 79.15, the settlement, that up 37.5. October, 80.55, the high, 79.85, the low, the settlement, 80.40, that up 50. October lean hog, 62.10, the high, 60.72.5, the low, the settlement, 61.02.5, that up 27.5. December, 59.50, the high, 58.30, the low, 58.90, the settlement, that up 2.5. February lean hog, 60.80, the high, 59.52.5, the low, 60.12.5, the settlement, that down 12.5. And April lean hogs finished down 45 today. The high was 60.80, the low, 59.80, the settlement, 60.15, again, that down 45. In August, pork bellies were off 50 cents today, 72.70, the high, 70.70, the low, 70.75, the settlement, again, that down 50 cents. The Dow is up 46 points at 10,560, the NASDAQ up 11 at 2148, and the S&P 500 two higher at 1221.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, working with the American farmer, creating products from his crops, creating markets for his crops. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Ken Gooding from Springfield, Vermont writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what happens if you get scared half to death twice?"
Well, then you're only a quarter here. Many a tenured professor or university administrator displays that effect. Perhaps they dared peek out of their ivy-walled fortress and glimpse the real-world job market, and that view proved so unnerving, their backs sitting at their desks, eyes wide open, staring straight ahead, but seeing nothing. Most of them simply count the days to retirement and hope nobody figures out their office hours.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. To purchase the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary Show on DVD featuring Dr. Science, Randy of the Redwoods, Ian Scholes, and other classic characters, visit drscience.com or call 800-989-DUCK.
It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock. This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. On the AM dial at 580 and online at will.uiuc.edu.